With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, the art and science of how we find and lose our way, with Michael Bond and his new book, Wayfinding.
Michael Bond, who won the British Psychology Society Prize in 2015 for The Power of Others, is a freelance journalist and former senior editor and reporter at New Scientist. Michael's latest book, which we're going to be talking about today, is Wayfinding, the Art and Science of How We Find and Lose Our Way. Michael, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much.
So tell us first of all what the idea behind wayfinding is.
So the book is basically about human navigation, how people find their way from A to B. But it's also about how we relate to the world around us and the importance of developing a sense of place and how the brain enables us to do that. And it covers various different sciences, including neuroscience and what's going on in the cells in the brain when we find our way or remember places that we've been to, and also some evolutionary biology looking at the ancient past of Homo sapiens and how wayfinding skills were crucial to our evolution and to our development, and then looking also at the effect of disease and illness on wayfinding skills and what happens when people develop Alzheimer's, which is essentially a disease of orientation, among other things.
So, I mean, obviously there's a lot of species of animals are able to find their way, some of them in lots of weird and wonderful ways. But we're talking about ourselves here, Homo sapiens. Let's go back to when we first started to find our way in any sort of intelligent way, I guess. Who were the first wayfinders?
Well, if you can imagine how in the era where modern humans were evolving, say 200,000 to 100,000 years ago, Homo sapiens would have lived in fairly tight-knit family units, and those units would have been quite isolated in the landscape simply because there weren't many of them around. But they were also very highly socially connected. The social networks of those early humans would have been pretty extensive, and they would have these family units would have traveled across the landscape 100 miles, 150 miles to visit their so-called neighbors in order to exchange resources or trade or obtain food, all essential things to their survival. But in order to be able to do that, they would have had to have known how to find their way across a fairly primitive, unfriendly landscape. And they would have had to have been able to walk and remember where they were going, change direction, and retain a sense of where their home was. They would have had to have been able to have had fairly extensive spatial memory of places along the route, because to be lost in that environment would have been almost certainly fatal, with the various predators around. Being lost on your own in that environment would have been a very bad thing to do. So these skills would have been developed in that era. And so humans really were wayfinders even back in those early days. And those skills have been retained by us. Our brains are still capable of that kind of navigation, even though we're often not usually called upon to do it.
And we're talking specifically about Homo sapiens here. So was this early form of wayfinding something that other species of human beings that have subsequently died out didn't necessarily do, and something that gave Homo sapiens an advantage?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Neanderthals, for example, along whom Homo sapiens lived in Europe for some time, they were also fairly sociable, and they moved around the landscape, but nothing to the extent that Homo sapiens did. And that, in one theory, is that that is what gave those early Homo sapiens an edge over, if you like, competitor human species. That ability to travel long distances gave them the advantage of retaining those large social networks, which was a great survival asset in that environment.
So how did, what sort of techniques would our early ancestors have used to navigate the landscape? And I ask this question because, you know, we can see there are certain techniques that a lot of indigenous populations around the world may still use that have obviously been lost by, like, huge parts of humanity. So what sort of techniques did they use?
Well, I mean, an early technique that a lot of existing indigenous communities have been found to use is simply when you start out from home, you step out for a certain distance one way and come back, and you repeat that until you know that route and you know your way home, and then you try another direction. And that way you build up a spatial memory of your home environment. And then you might try going a little bit further and remembering that route back. And so in that way, you build up a memory piece by piece before you embark on a more ambitious journey. But they may also have used tools, basic technologies, such as notching up marks in a stick to represent distance traveled, or they may have counted their paces. They may have had some system for remembering features of the landscape along the way. So all these basic techniques, I mean, the essential thing about being able to navigate is being able to pay attention and having awareness of where you go in order to remember the way back. So anything that would have helped them do that would have been beneficial.
And I wasn't aware until I read your book of the extent to which, in a lot of cultures, most cultures even, how the extent to which place naming is related to wayfaring.
Mm. Well, the great thing about place naming, naming a place you go to, is that, well, firstly, it can be very useful, particularly if you use a description of the place in the name. So just for example, there's a place where I've spent a lot of time with my family in Perthshire in Scotland, and there's a hill there that everyone knows. The translation from the Gaelic is Rock of the Birds. And that hill has, for as long as I've known it, and from what I hear generations past, has always been a nesting place for big raptors and corvids, and so birds that are very visible. So a place like that, you would know when you got to it. Rock of the Birds, you knew when you were there. The other advantage of place naming, naming places, is that it helps you retain a memory of a place. It's much easier to remember somewhere you've been if you can associate it with a name. And this even works for, I was recently talking to someone who works in search and rescue as a cave diver. He basically rescues cavers who have got in trouble underground. And I was asking him about how he remembers extensive networks of tunnels in three dimensions. And he said one of the essential things is that they name places along the way, a turn in a tunnel or a particular color of rock. So it has many advantages, being able to name, remember place names.
Let's talk about how we now, modern humans, how we develop wayfaring skills as children, and actually how this, in very recent history, is actually changing.
Mm. So children are natural explorers. And if you watch a child sort of venture out in their garden or somewhere they haven't been before, they have little fear of being lost. They will just follow their instinct. And if you ask a child to go to a particular destination, they will very quickly probably lose the idea of where they're meant to be going and quickly get caught up in interesting places that they find along the way. So they'll take a little path that they didn't know was there, or they'll find something interesting to play with. And for them, it's all about the journey. And this is really how humans, how we develop a sense of our surroundings and a spatial awareness, and also the confidence to move about in space and know that we can find our way and find our way home. And of course, today it's very difficult for children to do that because they usually are not allowed to roam by themselves very far. And so they don't get that spatial experience and are likely to grow up less confident as wayfinders and possibly less good at it.
You talk in the book about research into, you know, studies that have been done into where in our brain our spatial awareness comes from, where our wayfinding comes from. What do we know?
So this is a fascinating area of neuroscience at the moment, the discovery of cells in the brain that tell us about the space around us and tell us about how we move through that space. A lot of the excitement is focused on an area of the brain called the hippocampus. In the hippocampus, there's a set of cells known as place cells, which respond specifically to places that we move through, and they retain a memory of places. So, I mean, just to give you an example of how place cells work in the hippocampus, if you were to enter a room you've never been in, you go in for the first time, as you step into the room, one of your place cells in the hippocampus is likely to fire up, to activate, perhaps when you're by the door. And if you move across the room, say to the window, then another place cell will fire when you're halfway there. And when you get to the window, another place cell will fire. So as you move around that room and learn about that space, the place cells are firing up, and together they represent it's a representation of the space you're in. Because if you then go out of that room and then come back into it, say 5 minutes later, those place cells will fire up in exactly the same way they did the first time. So they retain a sort of map, a cognitive map, as it's known, of the environment. And then as well as place cells, there are other cells in the hippocampus, or the area around the hippocampus, which tell us about the distance we've traveled, the direction we're facing. There's another suite of cells that activate when we get to a border, a boundary in the environment, like a wall or some change in texture in the floor. So all these various cells, and more are being discovered all the time, they give us a good sense of where we are. They enable us to remember places and also to navigate through them.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Thank you.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Michael Bond. We're talking about his new book, Wayfinding, The Art and Science of How We Find and Lose Our Way. And Michael, I want to concentrate for the beginning of the second part on I guess, the loose question of why some people are better at navigating than others. We mentioned that there are indigenous groups around the world that still retain ancestral wayfinding skills that have just never been lost. There are also some languages that have a spatial aspect to them.
That's right. Essentially, those indigenous cultures where people seem to be extremely good, not just at navigating, but at knowing the direction that they're facing, for example, and have that great sense of how they relate to the environment. They're generally cultures where that's important. It's important to know where you are, and it may be that this is still an essential survival skill. And so they have to be aware, and words that represent space and distance have become more a part of their vocabulary. Because I think all humans possess the fundamental ability to navigate. I mean, there are some exceptions, but across all races and cultures, this is something that our ancient ancestors developed and that modern humans generally retain. The reason why some people are better than others, it's a great question and a big mystery, but there are some things we do know. I mean, one obvious one is we were talking about children before, but how and where you grew up and where you started to get a sense of yourself in space, that can have a profound effect on your navigation abilities later on. So if you had a free-roaming childhood and were allowed to explore by yourself and you develop those skills, then you're more likely to have a better sense of direction later on. But also, if you grew up in the countryside, for example, then that has been shown to give you an advantage over growing up in a city. And one reason for that is that the countryside there are fewer straight lines, there are fewer grids. It's harder to find a way from A to B. You can't just always follow a straight road. So you get used to having to adapt to that. In a city, often, especially a grid type city, you can learn a route left, right, left, and straight on. And that doesn't tax your hippocampus as much. I mean, other factors that come into play are personality type. People who are extrovert and particularly open to experience and conscientious all seem to be better navigators. And in some ways, the reasons are quite obvious. Navigation requires attention to detail, so conscientiousness is going to give you that. And extroversion, you're more likely to be looking around at your environment. If you're neurotic and you're going to be more focused on yourself, then you're less likely to be good. And then the other controversial factor in all this is gender, and this big debate as to whether men and women are as good or men are better than women. I don't know whether you want me to.
Well, I was going to ask you, there
that.
Is this, everybody knows this cliche that men are better at navigating than women or women are useless at maps. And I was going to ask where that comes from, because, you know, no doubt there's subsequently been studies done into the differences in gender, but this is like a folk myth, like an old wives' tale. People have always had this sort of idea. Where does it originally come from?
That's a good question. I don't know where it originally comes from. I mean, I think it's a, I think it, to some extent, it's a myth. Although a lot of the tests that psychologists carried out on men and women and their navigation skills do show that men have a slightly higher ability to find their way across a landscape that they're not familiar with. However, there are several reasons for this. And one point to make is that men and women tend to navigate in different ways. So if you're a man, you're more likely, and this is a generalization, of course, there are great exceptions, but you're more likely to navigate using a sort of bird's eye view of the landscape and referring to distant reference points and landmarks. If you're a woman, you're more likely to see the landscape in relation to your own position in space and to pay attention to close landmarks, nearby landmarks along the route. Now, both those methods can be extremely effective. It's just that a lot of the tests that are carried out tend to favor the technique that men use. So it looks as if women are worse, when in fact it could be just an effect of the test. But if there is an actual effect and women are worse than men, then it's unlikely to be due to an innate biology. This idea that when we were all hunter-gatherers and men would travel long distances to hunt and women would stay closer to home and gather resources closer to home, and that's how those differences develop. There's not any great evidence for that, for the fact that women would not have needed to navigate as well as men. It's more likely to be an effect of modern culture. I mean, girls, when they grow up, before the age of 7 or 8, are equally as good as boys at navigating and at other spatial cognitive tasks, mathematics and everything. But that changes soon after that. So by the time they get into secondary school, you see this effect. And there's likely to be a bias there in the sort of experiences that girls get. So they're not, parents tend to deny girls access to spatial toys, into Lego and bricks and map reading, those kinds of activities. So they don't get, for some reason, parents think that girls are not going to be interested or not going to be as good. And so they don't get that experience. And it's not surprising that they grow up to be not as good, because they simply haven't been able to exercise their brains in that way. So it's a sort of self-fulfilling bias. In a way, it's down to sexism, you could say, in society, that denies girls the opportunities that boys get to play with spatial tools and develop those skills.
You mentioned earlier the connection of dementia and diseases like Alzheimer's to our ability to navigate. But even you talk about depression can have an effect on an individual's ability to navigate. So what's the connection of these diseases to the area of the brain that we use for our wayfinding?
So Alzheimer's attacks that area of the brain where the spatial cells reside, around the hippocampus. That's very vulnerable. And so literally those cells start to erode away, and it becomes harder for sufferers to retain a cognitive map. In depression and other mental illnesses such as post-traumatic stress disorder, the hippocampus is also affected, and those cells are either not as active, or there's too much noise going on in the brain and makes it harder for us to use our cognitive maps in that way. But it's interesting that you mentioned depression. I mean, depression is on one level a disease of isolation and solitude, and the sort of language that sufferers of depression use is very similar to the kind of language that people use when they're actually lost in physical space, this sort of, you know, losing the path or gone astray. And so metaphorically the comparisons are similar, but also actually in the brain, because that part of the brain allows us to navigate. The hippocampus is also essential for mental health and for memory, imagination, and decision-making and other things. So being a good navigator and exercising the hippocampus has advantages for other parts of our cognitive life.
Well, that actually brings us neatly on to, I want to talk about next, what happens to us when we get lost. Because finding ourselves lost, especially in a, you know, a wilderness, a situation that could turn dangerous, is an incredibly debilitating thing to happen to our brains. Would you illustrate this with, in the book, you illustrate this chapter with the story of a woman, Geraldine Large. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us who she was and what happened to her?
Geri Large was a woman in her 60s who, 2013, was walking the Appalachian Trail, which is a trail in the eastern part of the U.S. that goes for some 2,000 miles up to the Canadian border. And Geri, when she got to Maine, so quite far north, she was doing very well at this stage, and she was a slow walker, but had no trouble getting this far. One morning, she left the trail, which was at this point going through thick forest, to relieve herself. And she walked perhaps no more than 80, 90 paces into the trees. And she couldn't find her way back. She forgot the direction that she'd walked in from. And she then spent the next few days wandering around, trying to send cell phone messages and ring her husband and the search and rescue team, but her messages didn't get through. And she ended up climbing up to some high ground and pitching her tent. And she spent the next 2 or 3 weeks there. And tragically, she was never found, and she died there. And so I spent quite some time looking into this story and following her route. And she was never found, despite being searched for by hundreds of local volunteers, very experienced search and rescue team in that part of Maine. And she was extremely unlucky. She didn't really do anything wrong. She obeyed all the instructions to stay put, to pitch a tent, to try and make yourself visible. But it's a tragic story, because imagining what she would have felt like, I mean, being lost, realizing you are lost, is a terrifying experience. Anyone who has experienced it will tend never to forget it. So she would have been suffering emotionally. And of course, if you're terrified, effectively, it's a panic attack you suffer when you get lost, then that it disables your rational decision making, and it makes it very difficult to make a good decision. And so people often who are lost tend to get themselves even more lost. But in this case, Jerry didn't really do anything wrong. She was very unlucky.
And you went to the spot where she'd pitched her tent, and then almost immediately almost got yourself lost as well.
Yes. So I went into the forest with her, with the GPS coordinates for where her last camp was. And I left the trail where she had left the trail, just to get a sense of what that landscape was like and what it would have been like for her. So I did. I found her, what was her tent. And there's a makeshift, there's a cross there and a grave. And I then put my rucksack down and took off my GPS and compass and everything, and just wandered around a bit. And I suddenly realized that I didn't know where my rucksack was, where the grave was, and I was actually lost. And having spent months researching this subject and knowing what happens in the brain when this happens, and knowing how people should behave and what they shouldn't do, all that went out of the window. I panicked. I was terrified, really, because I knew what had happened to Jerry. And I was fortunate, and I just stumbling around, I fell on my rucksack again. I was quite lucky, not through any navigation skill. So I did inadvertently get a taste of what people feel like when that happens.
Just one more thing then from me. Can we talk about what effect the widespread use of GPS and sat-nav is doing to our collective ability to navigate?
Well, I don't want to get too romantic about this, because GPS is obviously an incredibly useful tool, and there are some people who are terrible navigators who depend on it. But there's no question that using a GPS to tell you where to go, so following that set of instructions, it basically short circuits the hippocampus. Those spatial cells are inactive. I mean, this has been shown in experiments, and there's nothing going on. So if you rely on that technology, your navigation skills are likely to get worse. The unknown question, of course, is, well, the hippocampus is crucial for, as we were saying, a whole load of important cognitive functions. And the less you use it, then, you know, that's potentially dangerous. I say dangerous, I've used that word carefully, but there's a lot of work being done on just finding out how dangerous that is. But I think perhaps all that aside, the other thing to consider is that when you use a GPS, you lose contact with your surroundings. You don't get a sense of place. You don't have that connection with the world around you. And just from an aesthetic point of view, that's something to consider. For some people, that's not an issue, but I think it's just worth knowing what you're losing when you rely on that technology.
So I've been talking to Michael Bond. We've been talking about his book Wayfinding, The Art and Science of How We Find and Lose Our Way, which is out now in the UK from Picador. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about it.
Thank you very much, Neil.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89 Up and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.